Well, a city slicker was driving down an old country road when his car got stuck in a mud hole. He was spinning his tires trying to get out of the mud, but man, he was stuck. Well, in minutes, a farmer came by in an Oxtrong cart. He offered to pull the car out of the mud for $500. Well, the man had no choice. And so they hitched the car to the oxen and presto, right out of the mud. Well, afterwards, the farmer commented. He said, "You're the 10th person I've pulled from the mud today." The city slicker replied. He said, "Man, that's so kind. You're so generous. When do you plow your fields? You must do it at night." The farmer said, "Oh, no, that's when I water down the mud hole." Well, in today's chapters, Moses enacts laws that govern Israeli life in the new land they're about to enter. He deals with a host of various issues, but we start with a few verses on oxen. Verse 1. "You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother." Now, sin can be categorized in two types: sins of commission and sins of omission. A sin of commission is to do what you shouldn't, whereas a sin of omission is to not do what you should. And here Moses warns us about sins of omission. You see your neighbor's ox climbing through the fence. He's about to wander off. Don't ignore it. Don't refuse to get involved. Don't take the attitude, "Well, it's not my problem." No, love doesn't sit on the sidelines. Love your brother by helping him fetch and return his animals. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. You find his stray ox, or his forgotten wallet, or his lost iPhone. You don't stick it in your bag while you're singing "Finders, keepers, losers, weepers." No, you hold on to it until you can return it to its rightful owner. "You shall do the same with his donkey, and so shall you do with his garment. With any lost thing of your brother's which he has lost and you have found, you shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself." If you're leaving on a Sunday, and you see a nice jacket lying in the seat next to you. "Oh, it's even my size." Well, don't think God has blessed you with a new jacket. No, you turn it into the lost and found out here in the church foyer so that the rightful owner can retrieve it. And this is what us pastors do. I hope you know. I mean, we find a wallet somewhere on the grounds. We take out the cash. We put it in the offering box. I mean, why else would anyone bring a wallet full of cash to church than to make a donation? And so we help the brother out, and then we return his wallet. Got to practice what you preach. "Now you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again. See your neighbor's donkey or his automobile broken down on the side of the road, or if his ox is in an accident and you stop and help him, you need to do that. You need to stop. You need to help out your brother. Don't just drive past him, you know, without a care. You need to love your brother. Stop and help him out." By the way, what do you call it when two oxen crash into each other? It's called an oxident. Verse 5 changes the subject to a very contemporary issue. "A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God." In antiquity, dress was similar. Men and women wore long robes and wraps, but there were subtleties that distinguished them male and female. Likewise today, my wife and I both wear blue jeans, but trust me, there is no confusion between my jeans and Kathy's genes. When God created humanity, he made us male and female. Gender is God's idea. He created the sexes as equal but different. Both sexes play diverse roles in family and church life. And this is why God doesn't want anything to blur those distinctions. Here the concern is dress. Obviously, fashion is always changing, but whether you're living in 1400 BC or 2000 AD, men should look like men and women should dress and look like women. And I feel strongly about this issue. Modern culture laughs about this idea. But God isn't laughing. The Bible teaches that cross-dressing and masquerading as the opposite sex is not some fun, harmless fascination. It's a distortion of sexual identities, lines that we shouldn't blur. Christians should do all we can to promote masculinity among men and femininity among women. There's a lady in our church who always comes up and tells me, "Oh, for the day when men were men and women were proud of it." Well, verse 6 changes the subject again. If a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way, in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, with the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely let the mother go and take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days. Now here's one of the Bible's be kind to animal verses. A human can eat a mama bird's eggs, but be nice to the mama. Kindness to animals, prolonged occupation in the land. If Israel was friendly to its environment, then God would keep them as its custodian. It's interesting, the greatest commandment was to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. But the rabbis called verses 6 and 7 here the smallest or the least of the commandments. Be kind to a bird. And yet God is so gracious, they said, even the smallest commandment still came with a blessing. Speaking of kindness to animals, did you hear about the man who strolled into this ritzy restaurant in New York City with a dog in tow? Well, the maitre d' said, "Hey, no dogs allowed here." Well, the guy replies, he says, "But this is a talking dog. Tell you what I'll do. I'll ask him 3 questions. If he gives us the right answers, why not let us both eat for free?" The maitre d' agrees. And so the man asks the dog, he said, "Spot, what's the opposite of smooth?" He goes, "Roof." "Spot, what's the top of a house?" "Roof." Well, he looks at the maitre d' and he says, "Wow, 2 out of 2. Now for the grand finale. Spot, the greatest home run hitter of all time was Babe Roof." Well, the maitre d' had had enough. He grabs the man and the dog. He tosses them out on the street. They're lying there on the asphalt when the dog, he turns to his owner and he says, "I guess I should have said Hank Aaron." The moral of the story, be kind to animals. Well, verse 8. When you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet, or that is a roof wall, for your roof, that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it. I was once teaching in Haiti, and I was giving a gospel message, and I gave the invitation. And literally dozens and dozens of people, maybe 100 people, came forward to receive Christ. It was wonderful. Well, we had this second story room where we wanted to follow up with these folks. And so I directed the crowd up a flight of stairs. Well, that's when the building owner panicked, for there was no handrail. And he feared that someone might fall off of those stairs in the crunch and die. And then the locals would assume that his building was cursed and never return. He needed a parapet. This is what he says here. When you build a new house, make sure you got a railing up there for safety's sake. But I also think this verse symbolizes a spiritual responsibility. For we as leaders in the church and in the home, fathers and pastors, you know what we need to do? We need to set standards and boundaries. We need to set parapets or railings that safeguard folks, the folks that are under our care. People need spiritual railings and boundaries in their life. Well, verse 9, you shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. An ox and a donkey are different species. And put two animals together with distinct natures in the same harness, and they're going to fight against each other as they try to work. This is the backdrop for 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, where Paul says that a believer and an unbeliever shouldn't be unequally yoked together. Harness a believer and an unbeliever in a marriage or in a business partnership, any legally binding relationship, and there's great likelihood for conflict. You should steer clear of that. Well, verses 9 through 11 were to sensitize God's people to the dangers of mixing items with competing natures, whether it be an ox and a donkey or whether it be wool and linen. Verse 11, you shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together. Hey, partner up with an unbeliever, and at first it might be cool, kind of like linen. It's no sweat. But turn up the heat, put the pressure on, and it'll start to get uncomfortable. It'll start to itch and get warm like wool. See, wool and linen don't mix well. He was trying to teach them that they're are relationships and people in which you don't want to be unequally yoked. And then he says, you shall make tassels on the four corners of the clothing with which you cover yourself. Numbers 15, verse 38, remember, said that the tassels were to remind Israel of God's law. Now, verse 13, if any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her, and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found she was not a virgin. Now, often people will challenge you to show them where the Bible forbids premarital sex. Well, here in chapter 22, we find several examples. Among God's people, among the covenant community of Israel, when people married, there was to be the expectation of virginity. It was a highly valued virtue. Without it, a girl's chances of marriage were greatly reduced. Well, verse 13 here brings up a situation where a man accuses his wife of false advertising, of saying that she was a virgin when she wasn't. Well, when this happens, then the father and the mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. Now, it was customary that on their wedding night, the newlyweds would lay a cloth under them that would collect a few drops of blood created by the girl's initial intercourse. This was then given to the parents and kept as proof of her virginity. Now, today, gynecological exams and marrying at later ages makes this an impractical test. But in antiquity, remember, brides were often married at 13, 14 years old, very young. Thus, if the girl was falsely accused, the bride's parents would then present the proof of her virginity. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. Now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin, and yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city, and then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him. The man lied just to divorce his wife. And then they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel. He sullied a girl's good name and good reputation, and now he owes her a lifetime of care and protection, and she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. Get it? What? No, I hope you understand what he's saying. Verse 20. But if the thing is true, and evidences of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house. And the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. If the girl was guilty of adultery in advance, if the girl had been promiscuous in advance of her marriage, and yet she had claimed to be a virgin, thus she was taken out and stoned. Now realize, before Jesus, in the Old Testament, the law's priority was to define and punish sin. Today, though, we're under a new covenant where Jesus forgives and transforms a person guilty of sexual sin. Jesus' goal is to save us, not stone us. You remember in John chapter 8, the tender mercies that Jesus showed the woman taken into adultery. That shows you the mercy that Jesus goes. He said, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. And yet in all times, don't say premarital sex is no big deal to God, when clearly it is, and it was. Well, if a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die, the man that lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall put away the evil from Israel. Now, this was just adultery, and it too was a capital crime. Both the man and the woman were to be stoned. And this is why the episode in John chapter 8 was so suspicious. Remember, the gal was thrown at Jesus' feet. She was caught in the very act, we're told. But where was the he? Last I check, it takes two to commit adultery. That's why it was likely that the girl was a victim of a setup by the Pharisees. Verse 23. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city. And you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away the evil from among you. Now, the fact that she didn't cry out for help implied that the sex was consensual. It wasn't a rape, it was adultery, and it was punished. But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside and the man forces her and lies with her. Now, this is rape. This is not the woman's fault. She cried out, but no one came. She should be comforted, not condemned, as you read on. She now needs help and healing. Verse 28 tells us, if a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out. Then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. Now, the previous scenarios have all involved betrothed, or that is engaged or married folks. But here are two single people who are having sex outside of marriage. They're using each other for their own sexual gratification without making a marital commitment to one another. As we say down south, he's getting the milk without buying the cow. Or in the language of Scripture, he's humbled her. He's not giving her the honor that comes with marriage that he needs to give her. He needs to make an honest woman out of her, as sometimes people say. He needs to value her as his wife. But here's what I want you to notice. When does she become his wife? When they have sex? No. They don't become husband and wife until the man pays her father the bridal price. For this was how people in that culture entered into a marriage. So don't tell me that you and the person you're living with are married in God's eyes just because you're having sex with each other. No, the Bible is clear. God doesn't recognize two people as married until the bridal price gets paid or the legalities are complete, whatever those legalities happen to be in the culture that you're living in. Today in America, it's standing before a local official in exchanging vows. At this time, it was the bridal price, but you're not married until you go through the legal protocols. Well, the chapter closes with a prohibition against incest. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's bed. Don't have sex with your stepmother. Which was the sin that Paul was dealing with in Corinth, remember? In 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Apparently, not only did Israel need these laws, but they also provided a moral compass for the church. Deuteronomy chapter 23. Are you interested in this yet? Here we go. He who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Now, the covenant that God made with Israel and with Abraham was with his seed. It was a covenant that was inherited through human reproduction. And thus, a eunuch could never be a full participant in the life of the nation. He was limited. In addition, men often became eunuchs as part of their dedication to a pagan god. And so it came with idolatry. He goes on, he says, one of illegitimate birth shall not enter the congregation of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord. Again, this has to do with human reproduction. This was the old covenant. It was to Abraham and his seed. You became part of the covenant by being born of the proper seed. Ever heard the expression, a lot of water has flowed under the bridge? Well, here, 10 generations of blood had to flow to make an outsider a legitimate heir of the covenant that God had made with Israel. This 10th generation rule applied to mixed marriages with Gentiles, except for an Ammonite or a Moabite. For they shall never enter the assembly, he says, forever, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt. And because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. You remember the Ammonites and the Moabites, they opposed Israel as they were actually exiting Egypt at Israel's most vulnerable moment. And because of that, God says that they're not to become part of the covenant community. He says, nevertheless, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam. But the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. You recall Numbers 23 and 24. The king of Moab hired a sorcerer named Balaam to curse Israel. And four times Balaam opened his mouth to utter the curse. But instead, each time, God changed it to a blessing. God is still good at turning the tables on his enemies. You recall what Joseph said to his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. God says of Ammon and Moab, you shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. The ban on Moab must have applied only to the men, for their women did marry Israeli men, becoming citizens in Israel's community, for Ruth was a Moabitess who later became King David's great-grandma. And so Ruth, a Moabitess, was allowed to marry into the nation of Israel. Verse 7, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. The Edomites were descendants of Esau, Isaac's son and Jacob's brother. They were to be kind to the Edomites. You shall not abhor an Egyptian because you were an alien in his land. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Here's God's amazing grace in action. A former Israeli captor, someone who enslaved God's covenant people, an Egyptian, could now become a participant in God's covenant themselves. The next few laws address cleanliness and sanitation. Now, when the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. If there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but it shall be when evening comes that he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. Now, what kind of occurrence at night defiles a man? Well, maybe it's stepping on a kid's Lego and drawing blood. That would defile you. Of course, Leviticus 15 lists rules regarding bodily discharges. It could be that. But both required a temporary quarantine before they could re-enter the camp. And I love verse 12. Don't ever say the Bible is not practical. Verse 12. Also, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out. And you shall have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. What? That's why you need to read these chapters in advance. I bet you didn't know the Bible said that, did you? So if there's a soldier in battle who has to do a number two, he goes to a designated place, and when he finishes his business, he turns it over with a shovel. That's what it says. And I love the reason why you are to leave no chips unturned. Verse 14. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp. There you have it. God doesn't want to step in that mess. You got to turn it over, man. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. The Lord doesn't want to step in your mess when he walks through the camp. And this teaches us an even bigger lesson. It really does. For if we want God to walk among us here at Calvary Chapel, we need to bury the crap. You can quote me on that. If you want God to walk alongside us, we need to bury the crap. You can just interpret that however you want. We need to be holy. Verse 15. Now you shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. Don't return a runaway. There may have been a legitimate reason that he ran away. He may dwell with you in your midst in the place which he chooses within one of your gates where it seems best to him. You shall not oppress him. There shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. Now, ritual harlots were temple prostitutes. This land in which the people are about to enter, the land of Canaan, was a land steeped with idols. And it was full of women who would sell themselves, sell sex, to raise funds for their temple and for the priests of their idol. A perverted one was a homosexual prostitute. He says, you shall not bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog, which referred to the proceeds gained from male prostitution, the price of a dog, to the house of the Lord your God for a vowed offering, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. Prostitution played a huge role in Canaan's fertility cults, but it was to become no part in the worship of a holy God, of the true God. Now, verse 19, you shall not charge interest to your brother. interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. In other words, you weren't to make a profit on your brother, on a fellow Israelite. To a foreigner, you may charge interest, but to your brother, you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. Here's a joke for you. Why did God create Gentiles? Answer, somebody's got to pay retail. Anyway, Hebrews can make a buck off Gentiles, but don't charge your brother interest. That's what he says. Now, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be sin to you. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 5 puts it, better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Be careful when you take a vow. Be serious about it. That which has gone from your lips you shall keep and perform, for you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. We all should be men and women of our word. Now, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes at your pleasure, but you shall not put any in your container. When you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. This was a kindness to a traveler. As he passed through your vineyard or field, he could take just enough, grind it up in his hand for a little short snack or meal as he's passing through. But this didn't allow a bum or a crook who lived nearby to actually go out with a sickle and start harvesting your field. Now, in Deuteronomy 24, God is going to regulate divorce, which doesn't mean that he approves of it. Rather, his goal here is to discourage it. That's why he's regulating it. You remember Malachi chapter 2, verse 16 gives us God's attitude toward divorce. The Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence. God hates divorce. Malachi calls divorce a violent act. The Hebrew term divorce implies an amputation. It means a hewing off or a cutting off. C.S. Lewis once said of divorce, Christians all regard divorce as something like cutting up a living body, as kind of a surgical operation. Some think that the operation is so violent that it cannot be done at all. Others admit that it is a desperate remedy in extreme cases. They are all agreed that it is more like having your legs cut off than it is like dissolving a business partnership. And because of the devastating effects of divorce on spouses and on children, God formalized a procedure that made a divorce more difficult to obtain. He says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. Now, prior to this law, all that a man had to do to divorce his wife was to say goodbye. That was it. But now he has to obtain a certificate, which forces him to visit the city elders. And a hearing is now necessitated. And because of that hearing, a cooling off period comes into play, as well as public exposure of his intentions. Now the man seeking the divorce has to think, can the problems be worked out? Do I really want the public humiliation of admitting to a failed marriage? And because of these procedures, rash decisions are now avoided. Verse 2. And when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Here's another way that God's law discouraged divorce. Divorces were to be permanent. There was to be no going back, no changing your mind. And again, this made you think it through. Several years ago, I read of a man named Glenn Wolfe. Glenn died in a Los Angeles nursing home at 88 years old. Though he had left behind children and grandchildren and even great-grandchildren, no one came to claim his body when he died. In fact, the city had to pay for his burial in an unmarked grave. But what made Glenn's case so unusual was that he held a world record. Guinness listed him as the most married man. Glenn Wolfe was married and divorced 29 times. Poor guy spent his whole life looking for love, yet in the end, no one loved him enough to give him a decent burial. Maybe divorce isn't the answer after all. Maybe the best way to find love is not swapping spouses, but sticking with the one you got and working out your problems. The Bible teaches us that with a little humility and with Jesus' help, you really can learn to love one another. Well, okay, we need to pick up the pace a little bit. Verse 5 tells us that a newlywed husband was exempt from military duty for 1 year. He was to spend that first year strengthening his marriage and, I quote, bringing happiness to his wife. That would be a blissful year, wouldn't it, ladies? And yet you're not to take a man's millstone as collateral, either the upper or the lower millstone. Why? Because you take either one and he can't grind grain. It's both millstones that allow you to grind the grain. You cripple the man's ability to repay you. What good have you done? Verse 7 prohibits kidnapping and human trafficking. Verse 8, in a leprosy outbreak, be sure to follow the laws given in Leviticus 13 and 14. And then Moses adds in verse 9, remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. It's kind of interesting why he brings up Miriam here. Remember Numbers 12 recounts how Miriam, Moses' sister, bucked her brother's authority. And as a result, God struck her with leprosy. Verse 10, when you lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. You shall stand outside, and the man to whom you lend shall bring the pledge out to you. No illegal search and seizures. If you want to go into somebody's house, there's procedures that you have to follow. And if you collect collateral from a poor man, don't take his coat overnight so that he'll freeze in the night air. No, kindness to the poor is righteousness before God. Now, verses 14 and 15, pay your workers daily. Because some people are living from day to day, hand to mouth. They need that money at the end of a day's work. Verse 16, fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. And if you're not a father, let me just say, this is hard, probably hard to understand. But for you dads, you know that you can love your kids so strong that there are scenarios where you'd be inclined to die in their place if you could. And yet this was forbidden. Folks were to be judged on their own merit. Of course, the only person exempt from this is the lawgiver himself. For the one who gives the law is above the law. And thus Jesus was willing to die in our place. Verse 17. Don't pervert justice, do the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge. Don't pervert justice for the stranger or the fatherless. You know, in America today, often the outcome in court has nothing to do with justice, but with who can afford the best lawyer. In Israel, justice was due everyone. Now, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. This was the welfare system in ancient Israel. After the harvest, the poor could go back and comb the fields for the leftovers, for what was left behind. And notice, this wasn't a handout. For they had to go out into the field and gather the neglected bundles. The poor were emboldened by the dignity inherent in meaningful work. They had to go back and work for it and gain, you know, what was left over. The rest of the chapter tells us the poor had access not just to the field, but to the olive grove and to the vineyard as well. Well, chapter 25. If there is a dispute between men and they come to court, that the judges may judge them and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence according to his guilt with a certain number of blows. Now the judge set the number of blows in proportion to the crime. And I don't know about you, but there's some situations today where I wish we'd bring this back. What we're doing is not working. The judge was to set the number of blows in proportion to the crime and then oversee the punishment to make sure that it didn't exceed the sentence. Verse 3. 40 blows he may give him and no more. 40 was the limit. Lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these and your brother be humiliated in your sight. Now, Jewish tradition said that if the man administering the scourging exceeded 40 lashes, then he himself received 40 blows. And this is why, to be on the safe side, the executor, the man doing the punishing, the man with the whip, always stopped at 39. He never went to 40. He always stopped at 39 because he wanted to give himself a little slack just in case he overshot and ended up being punished himself. And thus, in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 24, when Paul lists his sufferings for the sake of Christ, he writes this: from the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. It was the 39. Verse 4, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Again, this is a be kind to your animal verse. Let your ox eat from the results of his own labor. And it's interesting, in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 9, Paul interprets verse 4 as a be kind to your pastor verse. That's right. Let the pastor eat from the fruits of his labor. In other words, pay your pastor. Verses 5 through 10 lay out the law of the liverite. It's the Hebrew term, liverite is the Hebrew term for brother-in-law. So, if a man died without an heir, his brother was to marry his bereaved sister-in-law and sire a son to carry on the deceased brother's lineage. The goal was that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. He was to carry on the family heritage. But if the brother didn't want to marry his sister-in-law, he couldn't be forced. I mean, his wife might have a problem with it. And in that case, the bereaved sister would take his sandal, then spit in his face, subject him to public humiliation for the slight that it was to her in his own dereliction of duty. And as wild as this law is, this becomes the backdrop for the beautiful story that we'll study in a few weeks, the story of Ruth. Verse 11. What? If two men fight together, and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him and puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall not pity her. Whoa, Nelly. Ladies, if you have to help your hubby in a fight, don't you hit below the belt now. Again, the offense here is not defending her husband. It's where she aims. In chapter 23, remember, an emasculated man was banned from Israel's covenant with God because the covenant was tied to the man's seed. And thus, an attack on a man's ability to reproduce was considered a major offense. And that's why she shouldn't grab his stuff. Today, though, salvation is by faith, not by human reproduction. We all come in not because we're born into the family, but because we put our faith in Christ. We come into the family by faith, not human reproduction. Thus, if a lady today is attacked by a man, then hitting below the belt with your knee or your foot is exactly where you need to aim. It's exactly where you need to go, ladies. And God will approve. It's another advantage of being saved by grace, not law. Amen? You CBI girls hear that? Good. Verse 13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. In antiquity, business was conducted by using scales. Gold and grain were always weighed, so make sure you use an honest scale. And make sure you have standard measurements. A cup or a bushel should be the same in your house as it is in my house. Now recall, as soon as Israel crossed the Red Sea, a nomadic tribe, the Amalekites, pounced on the newly freed slaves. Israel had yet to organize, yet Amalek attacked them at their weakest and most vulnerable moment. And so verse 19 tells us, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around, in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, you shall not forget. God didn't forget Amalek's ruthlessness, and neither should Israel. Four centuries later, God will command King Saul to wipe out the Amalekites, and it will be his unwillingness to do so that will cost Saul his throne. Deuteronomy 26 records the prayer that an Israelite prayed when he offered a tithe to God. See, it wasn't just what he gave that was important, but it was what he said along with his offering. And this is why I never just drop my offering in the box. I don't put my tithe in the box before I pray for it. Before I do, I sit there and I pray a prayer or a praise over my tithe as I put it in the box, because that's as important to God as the money itself. Well, in verses 1 through 4, you're told to bring your offering in a basket to the tabernacle and hand it to the priest. And then you're to repeat this liturgy, verse 5. My father was a Syrian. He's talking about Abraham. About to perish, and he went down to Egypt and dwelt there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and with an outstretched arm, with great terror, and with signs and wonders. He has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. And this is what our offering should say to God. You've done so much for me, Lord. The least that I can do is return to you a portion. Tithes were given to God each year. But in the third year, the tithe was to support the poor and the Levites. And verse 13 is the prayer that accompanied this offering. Notice verse 14, an important verse. I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for any unclean use, nor given any of it for the dead. Now, what does that mean? Given any of my tithe for the dead. See, among the Canaanites and the Egyptians, it was common to put food in a person's grave. sort of give them a snack for the afterlife. Their giving was tainted with superstition. And this is why the Hebrews disavowed participating in any of these practices. This is not what they did. And yet this applies to some folks today, I think. Because people can still be superstitious about their giving to God. They think their giving binds God to bless them in some certain way, or they're giving in order to get something in return. They're giving with strings attached rather than from the heart. Don't do that to God. Give because you love Him. That's why you give to Him. Well, finally, verse 16, Moses exhorts Israel to obey all the Lord's commands with all their heart and soul. They should walk in His ways, for verse 19 tells us, He will set you high above all nations, which He has made in praise, in name, and in honor, and that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as He has spoken. And thus ends Moses' second speech, his third and final, which will be a forecast of Israel's future, will start in chapter 27.